One of them wanted to be the security guy. He claimed he was a security guy.
Welcome to episode what, Mr. Jarvis? What number is this?
276.
276. Incredible. We're going to break 300 this year, you know.
Right.
It's unbelievable. Well, we're going to continue our series this week with Black Hat from Las Vegas that I did a couple weeks ago. And we remember last week discussing this, Mr. Jarvis. These are all the eggheads that really know what they're talking about. Three interesting shows today. One's from WebRoot. Now, WebRoot is like an antivirus program, malicious web program, mm-hmm. but they're way different. I started using them when they first came out about 5 or 6 years ago. And they're the only program like that that doesn't slow your computer down. You know how you put it on, you got to check. You can't even tell it's there. And wow. Really, really cool. Young guy came up with that. Vasco, and that's webroot.com. There's vasco.com. Vasco is used by like 9 out of the top 10 banks in the world. And they're concerned with your financial data and authentication. So, you know, if you log into your banking online, their job is to try to protect you. And what they do is, well, you may put in a password. Behind the scenes, they're gathering authentication information about you. In other words, let's say you always log in at your bank in Encino. And now you're logging in at an ATM in France. Mm. And you're calling in from a different number. And in other words, it learns your patterns as a banking person and then says, nope, we're turning that account off. Mm. This is how the banks protect their money with these algorithms. Very, really fascinating. Yeah. And then the last one is Cyber Reason. Now, that's C-Y-B-E-R-E-A-S-O-N. I guess they forgot the other R, but it's cyberreason.com. Ex-Israeli military, right? And so these guys work on protecting your data before, you know, the bad guy gets to your mm-hmm. to your network and stuff. And it's military-grade protection. That's how they describe it. It's really, really cool. So sit back and watch these. And remember, we got As Is coming up September 11th for the Friends of Chuck show. That's the first party we have on Sunday before the show. And 12, 13, 14, 15, I will be at As Is at my own booth.
Wow.
You got to come down there.
Yeah, I should. I will.
It's Orlando. It's not, you know, fancy. It's not Vegas. Oh, yeah. But it'll be back in Vegas again. But this one's Orlando. So let's talk about that. Maybe you can come help me be my engineer there.
Yeah, right? I would love to do that.
Need some help. Yeah. Big show, and we're going to be doing interviews at our own booth first time this year. We hope to get 100 of them. So look for more information, excuse me, on securityguyradio.com and social media. And let's play our three shows from WebRoot, Vasco, and Cyber Reason from Black Hat 2016 Las Vegas. We'll see you next week on Security Guy Radio. One, two, three. Welcome once again to another take of Security Guy Radio at Black Hat 2016. What's your name, sir?
I'm Grayson Milbourne.
And what's your role at your company?
I'm the Security Intelligence Director at WebRoot.
Now, it just so happens, WebRoot, I've been a customer for years.
Awesome.
I love it. Here's why. It's the only program I use that doesn't slow my computer down.
I'm glad to hear that, and we take a lot of care and effort to ensure that that doesn't happen.
Yeah, I didn't believe it at first when I started using it. It's not going to affect things. Baloney, because semantic, all those things, it just slows down to a crawl. How do you guys achieve that?
Well, it's a combination of a couple of different things. The first thing is that we ensure that our application is programmed to be as lightweight and efficient as possible.
It is.
And you might notice that the installer is under a megabyte, and that is compressed, but doesn't download anything else. There's no definition updates. It's just very intelligently coded. But beyond that, it also has to do with how our intelligence and our threat intelligence discovery works. And you might not know this, but...
I probably don't, by the way.
Well, I'm going to tell you. Not for long.
Everyone here at Black Hat.
So one of the things that makes WebRoot unique as a security product is that we've created what we call a collective intelligence model. And basically what that means is that every endpoint, yours included, contributes information about the files that you encounter and the websites that you visit.
Oh, that's why it asked me if I want to contribute. Okay.
Right. So
And your program is very big into that. In other words, it's very at the forefront of the loading. And I didn't want to understand the reason, but I'm helping you write your code.
Well, you're contributing encounter data, which is really important, because one of the biggest challenges in discovering threats is being at the point of where that threat's going to target someone. And that's normally the consumers using the internet, being normal computer users. Yeah. And so ultimately what we have is a big collective intelligence network of contribution from people like yourself. And when I talk about files, I'm not talking about your documents or anything else. This is just your application.
No, I don't want you looking at my porn.
We're not,
don't do that.
We don't
want
to look at that.
All right, good.
But the benefit of that is that we have the understanding of popularity. So like legitimate applications, they're seen by millions of people. And so we know that these are trusted applications. And so we don't have to monitor or observe those during execution to look for anything that might be malicious. But when you encounter something malicious, the odds are it's going to be unique to you. And so that allows us to really rapidly identify emerging threats as they're encountered by our customers. And in most cases, we're able to make a real-time on-the-fly determination of that threat.
Would you say that's the value add of Webroot, the correlation analytics behind one user's insight to threats and then sharing that with the community?
Yes, absolutely. And that's exactly what we do.
It seems different than the other competitors. Am I wrong?
It is different.
Okay.
I mean, we were really an innovator in this space, and you hear a lot about next-gen products today, but Webroot released Secure Anywhere back in 2011. So, you know, here the big news is always next-gen vendors offering endpoint security that offers a lot more functionality, but we've been producing that functionality for quite some time. and one of the big benefits of our product is that we have a technology called journaling and rollback. So if you get infected with something like ransomware, for example, and we didn't block it up front, there's a very good chance that we'll be able to remediate that encryption because the endpoint actually monitors what goes on an untrusted file basis.
That's fascinating. So I knew there was something different about it.
So you're, because ransomware is very popular right now. I mean, you can't go without hearing the news about some big corporation, whether it's the health industry, the financial industry. Now it's at the home level, and your novice user just is freaking out. So how do you guys help combat that?
So one of the things that's also nice about our program is that it has automatic remediation. There's no need to scan. And scanning an AV is something that people typically are like, oh, yeah, that's what it does, and it slows down my computer for half an hour.
That's what it does. Yeah.
Right? So for us, it doesn't quite work that way. We do support scanning because people expect there to be scanning, but in actuality, we're in what I would call a persistent state of connection with our cloud. So as you encounter something, we ask about it. And if we don't know what it is, we then record what it does on the system. We prevent it from accessing any sort of sensitive information. So it prevents keystroke logging and screen scraping and about two dozen other techniques. But if a later time we discover that thing that we were watching happens to be malicious, say like a new piece of ransomware, the agent next time it checks in says, oh, hey, that thing that I asked about, I now know what it is, so I'm going to act and I'm going to remediate. And this is all done in the concept of closing that window of time to an exposure to an attack. So the faster that you get to remediation, the better off you are, and it shouldn't be dependent on you having to kick off a manual scan.
So it's constantly monitoring my internet stuff, but I never notice it. I never notice a glitch.
It's, again, we do things very, very efficiently.
Yeah.
And so,
let's talk about that. How is when you're, you know, if we're sharing information into the cloud, how is that data being transported? Is it encrypted?
Oh, absolutely. So of course, data privacy is extremely important to us. We're a security company. So we do a lot to abstract user sensitive or user identifiable information.
Yep.
So, you know, one of the things we've done is we do a lot of normalization, right? So every Windows user has their own account, and that account name then shows up within the path directories. And so where something is found on your system, that's important metadata to us, but we don't really care what your username is.
Right.
So we normalize things from like the specific username, and we just put users instead of the actual username.
Oh, good.
And the other concept here is that we wanted to sort of create a master Windows file system in our cloud that supports Windows XP all the way up to Windows 10 server versions, 32/64-bit. And Windows changed the directory structure with Windows Vista. And there's other complexities, like multiple browsers have different cache locations. There's different temp directories throughout the Windows system. We normalize that all together so that something that comes in through your browser, whether it's Internet Explorer, Chrome, or whatever, that shows up in a cache directory. And so, this has helped us really organize a tremendous amount of data. We have about 10 million users contributing on a daily basis.
Oh, wow.
They generate over 1 million unique applications on a daily basis.
Wow, that's fantastic.
So it's really impressive, actually.
Who's your competition, or do you have any? Because you just seem so unique.
Well, we are sort of unique compared to our competition. I would certainly say that a lot of the next-gen vendors look at us as competition for
them.
But, we have a very big play in the consumer market, and we've been growing rapidly in the SMB market, where we have over 5,000 MSP resellers of our business product. And, you know, continuing growing the consumer space, even though it's a declining consumer market. So our product really works.
Now, how does it differ in the business market? Is it more robust?
It's actually the same code, same installer. It's all key code functionality driven, but we have a cloud-based console, so you can manage your endpoints simply through any browser login. Distribution of the endpoints is as easy as having them execute the installer, and they'll automatically check in, and it kind of creates that single pane of glass for remote management. But we also integrate with Kaseya, LabTech, ConnectWise, and a number of other RMMs.
So we talk about the consumer market kind of dwindling down, but what is your thoughts around securing the Internet of Things? That's a hot topic here at Black Hat this year. So how does WebRoot
absolutely
play in that space?
Sure. So we look at that as definitely an area that we want to participate in. Internet of Things devices are not going to be heavy computational power. So we already look at our technology as extremely lightweight and really well fitting for that. So it's something that we don't have a current IoT product, but we are certainly very active in that space and are looking to.
I think that's going to be a space that, you know, researchers are looking to innovate and figure out how to close that security gap on all these devices that are turning up, especially, you know, your connected refrigerator, your thermostat.
Right.
You know, why couldn't we install
or home security devices? Yes. I mean, that's to me is really where I get concerned about IoT is if somebody can remotely unlock my doors or I have a camera system. You know, that's
self-driving car I'm worried about, right? They hacked one once.
Absolutely. And it's great to see that because it's really important for security to be at the forefront of innovation in IoT, whereas so often we see security as an afterthought, and then it's so much more expensive to fix issues in that.
Now, why is the consumer market going down?
Well, I'm just saying the consumer PC sales are going down. So,
oh, they are? Because why?
Well, people, I think, are more into tablets. The computers last longer.
Oh, interesting.
You know, so it's been... So other smart devices that you can do additional computation on.
So to survive, you got to shift to a mobile market maybe, or you got to keep up with the hardware.
Interesting. Yeah, absolutely. So some of the other.
I guess I picked the wrong time to buy an $8,000 HP computer. I just bought one last week.
Wow, that's an impressive system then.
Oh, it's got like 64 gigs and 18 gigabyte graphic card. And,
awesome.
And the first thing going on next week is
WebRoot Secure Anywhere.
It's WebRoot Secure.
Awesome.
That's right.
So one of the other things I did want to bring up briefly was that because we have this collective intelligence environment, we have great telemetry into the actual threat landscape as it's encountered by our customers. And this allows us to look at some interesting data points, such as encounter trends with threats and the prevalency and turnover rate for variants of specific threats. And so this is something that we've been reporting on for a few years now. And what we've looked at so far in 2016 is actually somewhat of a decline in the encounter rate with new threats.
Oh.
And part of this is actually driven by the arrest of the Angler exploit kit cyber gang in Russia, where
that's interesting.
18 plus people were arrested, over 50 were detained. Yeah, this happened actually in early June.
Yeah.
And we saw like a very notable
direct correlation
to that going offline, because as an exploit kit, Angler had actually done a very good job of eating up market share and becoming the primary delivery mechanism for a lot of threats, especially ransomware. CryptXXX primarily delivered through Angler. But what we've since the early June takedown is a number of competing exploit kits really vying for that new top spot. And so we've already seen the nuclear exploit kit shoot up in market share, but there's about 10 other, you know, competing vendors out there who, you know, make their money by creating a platform for other cyber criminals to deliver their threats.
So let's talk about the threat intelligence aspect of WebRoot. How are you delivering that integrated threat intelligence that you just mentioned into the product, into the users?
Yeah, absolutely. So our product, you know, collects a lot of the threat intelligence. Our 10 million plus users are a great fishing net for what threats are encountered by real world users, right? They're just being people using the internet, and they become infected occasionally. So that is one of the big sources of our threat intelligence. But we also have more traditional methods that we used before we sort of went to this cloud methodology of sample sharing and file feeds. And we also have a global sensor network that identifies malicious IP attacks. And then our threat intelligence is also integrated into a number of next-gen firewalls. And so whenever that next-gen firewall queries against us, that's another source of intelligence. And if we don't know about something that's being asked about, it jumps to the top of our crawling queue as we discover new websites as they're published. So
now, you're not in the threat analysis business per se, but you just so happen the way you're configuring your system to collect the data.
Oh, yeah.
Do you resell that data to threat analysis companies that want to look at and crunch the numbers and say, you know what, I see, like you just said, hey, Russia gets arrested, boom, threats go down.
So one of the tools that we released at RSA early this year is called the Threat Investigator. And it's basically that So one of the big benefits, again, of all this data coming into our cloud from different sources is that we can then do what we call the contextual analysis phase. And this is where we look at file data, we look at web data, we look at mobile application data, and we are able to draw the lines and show the interconnectivity of, for example, where did that file come from on the internet?
Right.
What URL was hosting that file?
And you know because it's been in your system for 3 years and you can trace it.
Or it just showed up yesterday.
Right. Interesting. All
so,
right.
So yeah, we have an entire threat intelligence business that we brand under Bright Cloud Threat Intelligence.
What's it called now?
Bright Cloud.
Okay. What's the website?
Brightcloud.com.
And it's okay, good. B-R-I-G-H-T?
Yep, B-R-I-G-H-T, okay, cloud.com. Right. And so we sell basically access to our intelligence that can be used in a lot of different creative ways. But
oh, that's great.
We have over 40 OEM partners. Many of them are here at the Expo Hall. But you'll find WebRoot Intelligence all over the
embedded
place.
Everywhere.
It's embedded
wow.
in a lot of places.
Now, is that unique to your market? In other words, do the other competitors do that sort of thing? I don't.
Competition there, but you know we certainly have, I think, the most seasoned offering.
It's because the way you collect the data, the way you do it, it's just different.
Yeah. Exactly. I know a lot of our competition, or none of them that I'm aware of, has that popularity component. Yeah. And it's so powerful when, you know, so much of threats today really focus on evasion and, you know, being unique. And we really look at that's a dead giveaway. You know, why do you, out of 10 million people, have a unique application
right.
that's running from your temp directory and has made a startup modification yeah. to your registry? You know, to us, those are the really dead giveaways. And
now,
so,
I was speaking to a couple vendors who do business overseas, Germany in particular.
Mm-hmm.
You can't save anything.
No.
It's all private, secret, serial stuff. So if you're getting information from iPorn and putting it in the system and knowing what's going on, and you're not supposed to save it more than 30 days, what are you
right.
doing in Germany?
So European data privacy laws are somewhat of a challenge, but the way that we encrypt our data and remove any sort of user identifiable or personally
okay.
identifiable information
okay.
actually gets us around that.
And that's good. Before it even gets to you don't know who I am.
Right,
I'm just
exactly.
an IP address.
Yeah, exactly.
All right.
And even IP addresses are obfuscated, so our threat research team really has no way to identify whose data that is.
Okay.
Like, we separate our customer service interface with our threat research interface so that, you know, the key code couldn't even be looked up. So
separate company, separate places.
Yeah,
good.
Exactly.
That's brilliant.
We abstract
all right.
the data. So
common sense, but you don't see much of that anymore.
You don't, unfortunately.
right. Now, so, any challenges, I guess any Apple-like challenges where law enforcement says, hey, WebRoot, I got to have this data. And you say, well, I'm not so sure about that. You don't have to name specifics, but
yeah.
you get these sort of requests.
Not that come across my desk.
Okay.
You know, we're a U.S.-based company, and so we'll probably abide with U.S. laws as we operate.
Oh, that part way. I get, but, you know, sometimes it gets to a point where they're just too nosy to me.
Yeah.
Right? And
sure.
it's like, you know what? Go build your own server if you're so smart, because they don't think they're so smart.
Yeah,
government, right?
yeah, absolutely. I mean, ultimately, we want to contribute to a safer environment
sure.
for everyone. And so, you know, I think one of the big challenges the industry faces is that there is very little repercussion for participation in this very lucrative industry. You know, we see things like ransomware as a service where, you know, you simply go to a Tor website and you enter in the Bitcoin address that you want people to send payments to, and the guy takes a 10% cut and you get the rest. And
wow.
what did you do? You went to a website and entered in some information. You know, no programming experience required. Just the cybercrime as a service space is enormously competitive. It's very inexpensive.
First time I'm hearing it that way, cybercrime as a service.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Write that down, because there's a couple of people I want to send that to.
And you know what?
It's
everywhere. It's from helping you develop your code to supporting the infrastructure to host your botnet to liquidating whatever you
wow.
stole. There are people along the way to help really make it a very easy process.
Now, I have another one I use, which we're going to talk to today, and Malwarebytes.
Malwarebytes.
Yes.
I can never get bits and bytes right.
That's
so stupid. Security guy radio. It's an idiot.
Bits and a byte.
All right.
Oh, there you go.
Oh, okay. Don't. Now your math is complicating me. All right. So I can't stop laughing. All right. Distinguish the two products. Are they different? Because
they are.
That's what I thought, and I had an intuition about that because I run your stuff, and then I just downloaded them yesterday and ran it,
mm-hmm.
and I found things that you didn't find.
We get this a lot, actually, and the issue is with how Malwarebytes actually quantifies its detections, and it looks at the registry and detects lots of things in the registry
right.
that are artifacts of previous infections, perhaps,
okay.
or false positives.
Fair enough.
We can't. You know, I can't always speak to their detections, but I'll tell you one of the core differences between the products is that Malwarebytes is traditionally a free product that offers remediation but no real-time protection.
Yes.
And if you buy their product, you then get the active shields. Whereas we don't really have that model. We have a 14-day trial that's the full product. It does everything you would expect it to do. And Malwarebytes is a little bit more of a system performance hit, but you know, I do give them credit as they are very effective at remediation.
Well, I was trying to get to not compare competitive, not compare that wise, but you know, and I don't know all this stuff. You know this, but is there a difference between you know a Trojan, you know, really bugs into that freaking adware?
Right.
I got Microsoft Image Composer, which is a 25-year-old program, and ever since I've gotten it to this day, when I'm imaging something. Buy Hanes underwear pops up right on my screen. Like, I can't get rid of it, right?
Huh, yeah.
So is adware different from a Trojan, which is different than a virus?
Yes.
They're all different.
They're all very different.
But do all programs capture all of it or some, most of it, or what?
Well, so it all falls under malware. And then, you know, adware is really designed to interact with your browser and to sometimes change the browsing behavior.
Yes.
We look at that as malicious, and so we would remove adware that affects your browser.
Because it used to be back in the day, you had to buy an adware removal program.
Right.
And that's not the case anymore.
Not the case anymore.
Okay.
And in fact, Webroot's first security product was called Spy Sweeper, and we released that in 2003.
Oh, I remember that.
Right? And this is when, you know,
that was a great
product. Web search and all these types of threats were out there, which were very much in the adware space. And then hackers started realizing, hey, we can make money because people are now doing online banking and online e-commerce. And it shifted from you know advertisement-based revenue to data collection-based revenue. And today, so that's the largest group of threats that we see are financial-based Trojans that, again, look for your credentials, look for your online transactions. But ransomware certainly today is also you know the fastest growing type of infection. Simply because it's so effective at getting people to pay.
Well, it removes that middleman. You know, no longer are the days when you have one hacker stealing the whole kitty of accounts and PII. Now it's just go direct to the user and demand the ransom.
And the thing that we're really seeing shift here is that ransomware is typically pretty blind about what it's encrypted and how much the ransom should be.
Yeah.
And what we've seen already this year are a couple of examples of where, you know, the Presbyterian Hospital in Los Angeles.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they originally asked for $3.5 million.
Dollars. Yeah, we did talk about that.
And then they dropped it down to $17,000, which is quite a dramatic decline. But it shows that, you know, they're really looking to understand who they've infected, what value that data really has to them, and try to set a price point that's, you know,
it's kind of a new market.
Right, exactly.
New price point. Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think we're going to see an evolution of ransomware for a while till they kind of find that happy median of what's effective for the biggest bank.
But can't you just defeat it if I back up my data on a regular basis and say, you know what, screw off, I'll just reboot and whatever, right?
That's really the ultimate way to end this infection is that we need people not to pay. But right now people pay, like at an alarming rate.
They panic.
They do.
And there are some tips. Can you share with us some tips on how to...
Yeah, so, you know, I love cloud storage solutions, right? Dropbox, everybody knows about it. They keep backup copies of your files. And so I look at, you know, if you really want to save something, don't save it to your hard disk. Save it to a cloud.
I use Dropbox,
There's redundancy there.
But doesn't the certain types of ransomware, won't it spread to the shared drives if you're shared automatically to
No, they often will spread to shared drives. And then this is where we really see it in businesses getting hit hard, is that they have users who are connected to remote shares, and then those shares end up getting infected. But ultimately, you want to have a backup. And really, you know, if you care about your data, you should have a backup. And if not, and ransomware hits you, you shouldn't then be upset about losing that information.
Yeah.
Well, see, with the average consumer, my cousin's not going to get this. They're not that sophisticated. Is it a average consumer issue? We were talking about the other show, $1,500 is an average price for some average kind of ransomware.
With the Bitcoin value, which is also very, you know, fluctuates a lot. So... I would say it's more of a consumer problem than it is a business problem.
Okay.
But businesses are certainly getting hit by it.
Right.
So they're very concerned about it.
But
there's no question.
Most businesses have the process and controls in place to mitigate it and minimize
it. No, that's
the
a good point. Yeah.
Where a normal user or a small business may not have the know-how or the capacity to do it.
Right. That makes sense.
Pay. Right. And another trend we've seen is that the businesses who do pay often get re-hit again because now they know, hey,
that's my point.
Right. So my advice is to never pay. And I was really frustrated when the FBI actually came forward and said, well, we recommend paying the ransom.
You know
And I was like,
don't listen to anything they say.
Are you kidding me, guys? Like,
no
what?
One in law enforcement likes the FBI, okay? So I can say that because I was in law enforcement, right? And that's just like you see these the cop shows on TV. Bad guy takes somebody hostage and they tell the cop, drop your gun. Guess what, pal?
Yeah.
That ain't going to happen. I'm going to shoot you in the head. When you acquiesce, that's what happens. It causes more problems.
Yep.
So it is frustrating. I can see where you would say that doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah.
I would just say, well, I learned a lesson. Next time I'm not going to do that and not lose my data. But and if they steal Target's data that way, or the hospital's, they still have it, don't they? I mean, they're locking my computer down to one degree, but isn't it possible they're also taking some of the data?
So we actually see this a lot. And with Angler, though now it's offline,
right.
What we saw in most cases was they would send down CryptXXX followed by the Carpera financial Trojan. And basically, you now have a financial Trojan that's watching you as you go online to buy your Bitcoins.
See?
And they catch you in both spots, really.
Right, right.
Wow. Yeah.
So they know what they're doing.
I mean, ransomware is mostly about locking your computer up, not usually about stealing data. Yeah. But that's the next logical progression to me.
Right,
absolutely.
Now, by the way, here's the file that I have all your files. So let's pay for it again. Right, yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, Grayson, this has been really fascinating.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
Give us your website again.
It's webroot.com, W-E-B-R-O-O-T.
And I've been using you guys since the beginning when it was the other SpyCatcher. I used that. SpySweeper is a great program, and it works. So
it
it's always nice to use products that work.
Absolutely.
Thanks for coming on Security Guy Radio.
It was a
appreciate
pleasure.
It.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Grayson.
Awesome. Appreciate it.
All right, that was good.
Yeah, it was fun.
All right, welcome to Security Guy Radio with Black Hat 2016 Las Vegas. What's your name, sir?
John Gunn.
And what's the name of your company?
Vasco Data Security.
And what does Vasco Data Security do?
We are the leader in helping banks protect online and mobile banking transactions.
The leader, that's good.
The leader. So if you globally, in fact, more than half of the top 100 banks around the world use our solutions to keep hackers from taking over online banking transactions. Do you do online banking?
Yes,
I used to.
I do, unfortunately.
Do you do mobile banking?
Well, I used to do Quicken to check my accounts, and then I thought, you know what? I don't need to. I can wait until I get home, right? It was convenient and everything. But I'm a little nervous about it because the risk-benefit analysis to me is convenience over – not that I have any money in my bank account, but, you know, why bother going through all the paperwork? But this is what you work to solve, is this kind of thing.
Yes.
And I noticed on your website, you got like 8 out of the top banks in the world in there, or 9 of the top 10 banks. You get some big players in here.
We've got a lot of them.
Yeah.
We've got a lot of them. Yeah, half the top 100, and we've got about 1,700 and growing.
Now,
because hackers are attacking online and mobile banking increasingly.
Now, when did your company come of age and really start hitting this, you know, big time? Because mobile banking is, well, you know, in the age of things, it's fairly new in a way, right? Were the banks just not interested in security back then, thinking nothing's going to happen? Now they're saying, oh, crap, we should have been on that from the beginning.
You know, banks have always been very interested in security. They've always had a big focus on it. But for banks, it's always a balance because they want to keep their customers happy. And, you know, if you've ever been a long line at the TSA, you know, you dread security, but you want to be safe when you fly. But you have to go through TSA to fly. But if one bank makes a higher level of friction for you with security, you might switch banks.
That's interesting.
So banks have to balance that. How do I keep my customers happy? And how do I absorb the losses? Because they absorb the losses. I mean, if your money is stolen from your account, you don't lose it. The bank does.
Well, that's true.
So they have to balance that. But they've always had a big focus on security. And they do a lot of things behind the scene you're not seeing already. But the attacks have become more frequent, much more sophisticated.
Yeah.
So as the hackers have upped their game, the banks have had to do the same. So it's this technology chase.
So let's talk about the most recent hacks. I'm sure you're very aware of the SWIFT attacks, the New York Federal Reserve versus Bangladesh Central Banking. How has that impacted your business and or how are you helping to solve that problem?
That impacts our business in that people, that one doesn't direct our business as much as the attacks on mobile banking. And let me change that question around a little bit. There's been a huge rise in mobile banking. The Federal Reserve keeps track of that. KPMG just came out with a study on it. And mobile banking is becoming the number one channel. So banks suffer fraud through all types of channels. The one you mentioned, and they're doing transactions between banks. They suffer fraud at the ATM. They suffer fraud in branch, insiders. But we focus on the online channel, the mobile channel, and then also the ATM now as well. Our solutions are now used at the ATM. Imagine you're at your ATM getting money out. Hackers love to steal cards. In fact, right now you could go, if you could have access to the dark web, you could buy stolen ATM cards and pins, and you could go to the branches. You could even buy zip code so you get a local branch. That way the bank's less likely to catch the fraud. So how does the bank stop that? Well, one way is to know if you have your mobile phone. Because I could buy your stolen ATM card, but I can't physically buy your phone. So there's a lot of new things we're doing to help banks reduce fraud.
It's like a key, your phone
it's
now.
Like a key.
I've seen that more and more. Quicken's very good at calling me after I log in, and I put a PIN back in, and authentication. And I think it's a big pain in the butt, but I do it because it works, right?
Well, you hit the nail on the head.
Yeah.
The pain in the butt. That's what I talked about earlier about banks want to avoid that pain in the butt.
Right.
So the idea is to do as much security in the background as possible. So our solution, what banks can do now is, if you're doing an online transaction, let's say a mobile transaction on your phone, I can do all kinds of things in the background that I can tell the bank about you. It's not a violation of privacy.
Right.
Okay. But it raises a level of security and helps them identify fraud.
Can you share some of those back in?
I would love to.
Proprietary secrets, yes.
Thank you for asking. One of them is your geolocation. Is your phone in the location where you normally are? You know, usually people get money in ATM or doing a transaction where? At their home, at their work, maybe at a friend's house or at a lot.
So you're saying they normalize your behavioral analytics, call that.
That's what we use. Risk analysis.
Very good, Charisse.
there may be a place for you at Baskin. We need smart people. We're hiring like mad. So, but that's one of geolocation. The other one is just your device. Is that really your phone? Hackers can clone your phone, make it look like your device. So we take a deep, deep look into the phone and say, is this really that phone? So the bank can say, if it's your phone in your location for the type of transaction you normally do, they can raise that, and they haven't made you put a pin in or anything like
that. No, you haven't done anything yet.
Yeah, now pins are still very valuable, but the more we can do in the background now, the more valuable that is.
It seems like a lot of latest identity technology is moving away from that two-factor authentication, the pin, the secret question, because they're finding studies that are ineffective in such a way that it's easy to fraudulently impersonate or gain access to that information. What are your thoughts on that?
You are well informed on that. That is a big problem. And that's an example of hackers keep getting better at defeating the current mechanisms. And it is a way to do that. So what we're doing is it goes beyond two-factor. It's called multi-factor. Mm-hmm. Those items I mentioned, checking the geolocation, checking the device, and other measures are all different levels of authentication.
Behind the scenes still.
Behind the scenes.
Before it gets to me, okay.
We now have selfie authentication or face recognition.
Oh, I've heard about that, yeah.
Within 2 years, every phone that ships will have biometrics. We can tell if you opened your phone with your finger or a pin. For example, if you left your phone on the desk and it wasn't locked, someone could walk up and transfer money themselves.
Right.
So now if you lock your phone, it's a little more secure. So the bank needs to know these things so they can do that risk analysis and decide, is this a safe transaction? So we give the banks all these methods to identify fraud and stop it while still keeping customers happy. Because mobile customers are very important customers to banks.
So I've been using PayPal for a long time. And back in the day when nobody really cared, it didn't seem important. I don't remember that they've really upped their security in front of me. But it sounds like behind the scenes, because right now it's still log in. Oh, let's give you a 4-digit PIN. It's a lot faster and easier for you to get in. I don't want it to be faster and easier for me to get in, right? but I mean, is PayPal an example of a challenge here where behind the scenes they got all kinds of stuff I don't know about? And you know, because it's so easy really to get into PayPal.
Yeah, now, I don't
with the mobile app especially.
Yeah, I don't work directly with PayPal, but I guarantee you that with the amount of transactions they do, being a market leader, they have all kinds of risk analysis going on in the back
that we don't know about. Yeah,
that you don't know about. Looking at behavioral characteristics, looking at your typical transactions, who you're typically paying, so they can identify fraud. The other thing that is a common misconception is that people like PayPal, people like banks, they want to eliminate all fraud. That's a lofty goal, but it's really about how do you reduce fraud. The only way to eliminate fraud would be to stop doing transactions.
Right.
So you want to get to a level that's acceptable, and you want to invest to that point. The challenge is the bar keeps getting raised by hackers. They have more sophisticated means. For example, can I give you an example?
Please do.
Okay, NIST, the government agency that sets the standards for the government, just came out, and they shared their guidelines for authentication. You've read about this.
Yes. And integrated with the FFIEC.
It was huge news.
I got to watch these acronyms now.
Because they use the term deprecated, their term, not mine, SMS. A lot of people at their banks, when you use a device you haven't used before, doing a transaction, that's funny, they'll say, we want you to enter a PIN, we're going to send it to you by SMS. This said, no more.
It's probably sent through clear text.
That's not a safe way to do it, and hackers have developed ways to attack that in large scale. It's all about scale for hackers. So they've said, in our guidelines, we're going to move away from this. And so this is an example of where hackers keep upping their game, and the industry will have to respond with more sophisticated means that don't put a lot of friction in the transaction.
Well, what about the end user? Let's talk about that for a second, because you're only as strong as your weakest link, and human factor is usually the weakest link. So you can put all these controls on the back end, hiding it from the end user to be more seamless and not create a lot of steps for them. But how do you get that mindset to change to common, what I like to call cyber hygiene? Don't share your passwords. Don't unlock your phone. How are you approaching that problem with your solutions, if you are at all?
Yeah, we do exactly.
And if they are at all.
Yeah. We're not. We're a bunch of derelicts. Of course we are. But you know, there's part of it you can't fix. You know, people always have a self-interest, and you know, they'll get an email, you just won, or here's a shipment,
yeah.
Or they'll play on their fears. You're overdue and your account will be shut off. Ooh, I better open that. So people will always fall victim to social engineering, and there's no way to stop that. But what we stop is what the hackers do after you become a victim of social engineering. Here's an example. A really common attack it's a brand new attack that's becoming more common, is to attack mobile applications by getting you to download a fake bad app.
Yeah.
Yes. Here's a notice from your bank. If you want to keep doing online transactions because of security, we think you may have been attacked. We protected you. Download this new application so you download it. It may not be the bank's real app, because what hackers will do is they'll download the bank's app. They'll reverse engineer it. They'll change it and put their evil code in it.
Yep.
Then they have to get it out on as many phones as they can.
Wow.
They'll put it on rogue stores. Then they'll do the social engineering. So a couple of solutions we have to stop that. One is we stop the hackers from reverse engineering the bank's code.
Okay.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
How do you do that?
It's called obfuscation or hardening. So it also stops it from piracy, which is not as big a threat right now for them, but it stops them from reverse engineering it. Or it makes it so much more difficult that they can't do it.
Go to the guy that's not protected. Right. Go to the next guy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Just like how you protect your house.
Right.
If someone breaks into your neighbors. If they want, and they can eventually get in.
Absolutely.
Then the other way is when that mobile application is executing, is we look at the way it's executing. And if it's doing things it shouldn't be doing.
Because you know what the pattern is for legitimate programs.
Yes.
Microsoft did that years ago.
Yeah.
They said, you know, Word opens and works a certain way, and if you had some kind of pirated version of it or something, and it didn't perform the same way. They
just
looked
like
at the
that.
Behavior. Very interesting. Okay.
Exactly. If this application is trying to write a screen over the existing screen, a hacker would do that, because if you enter a banking transaction, say I want to send $100 to Kansas, it's sending $5,000 to Eastern Europe, it's still showing you the wrong screen. There's no reason why that banking app would have two screens and have a screen overlay.
Yeah.
Or if it's writing to memory where it shouldn't, or doing a keyboard action. So we identify all that and we say, whoa, this should not be doing this, and we can stop the transaction. There's still the second step of you get a notice saying you can't complete the transaction, please call the bank.
Right.
And then when you call the bank would tell you, well, you may have malware on your phone, go to your local phone center. But we stop the transaction. It's only a few people that get attacked that way, but if you scale it towards millions of customers, and the largest banks in America have 20 million plus each.
Right.
Mobile banking customers.
Oh, mobile
it's
only.
Huge. It's huge numbers. Yeah, it's huge numbers. It's becoming the number one channel.
Wow.
So it's becoming the number one place to attack. If you're a hacker, where are you going to go?
Yeah. Now, what do you think about biometrics in this space on my side of the end user space? So would it help if we had something I know, something I am, and something I, what's the three things? Something you are, have, and...
What you do, what you have, and what you know. Yeah, you know.
There you go. Yeah, those three things.
What you are.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know your password.
Right.
You might have a token or a PIN or OTP. Let's say you press a button, get an OTP, and then who you are.
Right.
Or what you are. It's expanding now.
Now, do you use that kind of stuff inside behind the scenes, or if what you do is incorporated on my side of it, wouldn't we all be safer? Hey, I'm Bank of America, and guess what? You're going to do it this way. I just don't want your business. I know they don't want to do that because they can take so much loss and say, I can write that off. But what I'm worried about is not Teresa's account getting hacked. I'm worried about every single account getting hacked simultaneously one day, and America's broke. I mean, it can happen. Eventually, somebody's going to figure out how to drain the federal bank, all right? So wouldn't it be better if we all participated on a local level? And I always go back to this on my show. All security is personal. It's all local. It's all now. Because you can only protect me so much, and then I got to take my step and say, you know what? I'm turning off my phone. Because like you just said, end users are going to make mistakes and do things, you know. So any of those three-way authentications involved in what you do behind the scenes?
I agree with you 100%. People have a personal responsibility. And, yes, it does. As we get more biometric methods, to verify who you are. There's more information we can give the bank. So if you have, if you're able to fool or spoof, if you're a hacker, part of the, if you're able to cheat part of the mess, the system, we can still tell if it's really you by your face now. Tomorrow it'll be your voice.
Oh, good.
And then a couple of years from now, as the Internet of Things starts to grow and you have more devices, you know, in the future, envision that we can tell if it's your Fitbit. If every time you've gone to the ATM, you've always had your Fitbit or some device, wow, that's the Internet of Things, or you've always had your car nearby, and now you, now your car has an IP address, your car
that's
has an
true
identity. We can say, hey, five of the things that have always been there during this transaction are missing. The bank can say, maybe it's an anomaly, but then they can raise the bar and say, okay, now we need you to identify yourself.
Yeah.
You know who's good at that? Higher level.
Capital One's very good at that. I can't make more than two transactions in a week, and they're not calling me and shutting my credit card off saying, wait a minute, you don't usually get a manicure and a pedicure. What's going on? And yeah, and they turn you off, right?
Yeah.
And or if I travel and I fill up at a gas station that's out of state, I get a call right away.
Yeah.
I'm talking about real time.
I mean, yeah, yeah.
And I'm very impressed by that.
Yes.
So this is kind of what's going on with your company behind the scenes. We're looking at real-time analysis of how people behave and saying, wait a minute, better turn that off. We better take a warning. We better do something.
Here's an example. When they call you, when banks call you, not all of them now, but increasingly when they call you to say, are you really doing this? They'll be testing your voice to see if that's really your voice.
Oh. Wow.
So, and that's another example of something behind the scene where biometrics, which you asked about, it will be used in the future. For
interesting. Them. Well, they should test their voices. I can't understand half the people that call me in the first place. That's a whole different story. Offshore calling or whatever they're doing. But I am pleased that we're staying on top of these things. I agree with you that it can never be completely solved, and I think if you try to go that way, you're fooling yourself, and you're going to miss the ability to get what you can, you know. What's the next big thing that you're worried about when it comes to banking?
You know, it's just the scale of the attacks. It's some people use the term a whack-a-mole. As soon as you solve the problem, somewhere they attack somewhere else. So, and here's an example of that with the EMV cards. You've got your EMV credit cards issued by your bank now,
yeah,
and you have to insert it at the checkout instead of swipe it.
Oh, the chip,
Yeah, that chip.
Right.
The chip, the EMV cards. So because of that, fraud in retail stores is going to go way down. So you think the hackers are going to say, hey, we had a good run. Let's go lay in the beach somewhere.
That's true.
Yeah, not a chance. So they're going to attack banks more.
Right.
Find
so we look at these. Because, I mean, they have all these resources. They're going to attack somewhere. So we look at the next place they're going to attack. That's why we're looking very hard at the ATM, which we think will be another channel they'll attack more frequently at. That's why I've referenced it several times. It's still a big vector for losses or a big source of losses
right
for them. But there'll be more attacks. There'll be more sophisticated attacks. And we think mobile, there's about to be just a firestorm there because it's this emerging channel. People are using it. It's on their personal device. You talked about social engineering, big factor. So we look at these new methods of attack, and we always try and help keep our banks stay one step ahead of that.
Is there going to be a resistance from the consumer that the more points of identification you want from me, eventually I'm going to say, you know what, I'm done. I'm not interested. And maybe that'll make the mobile business back off a little bit. I mean, I know people that will not put their fingerprint on their phone. They will not do certain things that are biometrics. You know, they won't go through a checkpoint that has a
iris
scanner.
Yeah.
Because they're freaked out that, oh, my iris is in a file somewhere. Okay.
Yeah.
So I have a different thought of it, right?
What's your thought?
Well, my thought's open source. My thought, if all this stuff was not secret, it wouldn't be worth anything.
Yeah.
And then it would be a trust factor. We'd be back to, I trust you not to take my social security number, and you trust mine. Because if you take mine, I'm going to take yours. And so it kind of like a, you know, it neutralizes things. I know that's a fantasy in a way, but it's not, that type of behavior is not unheard of in other social situations. When you trust somebody, you engage in all kinds of behavior you wouldn't if you didn't trust them, right?
Yeah.
So the fact that it's secret, encrypted, and it's personal, people want more of it. Somebody hacked my website before I came here. I hope they steal my show. I'm happy for it, right? My show's, it's not worth hacking, right? But they just wanted to do it because they could.
Yeah.
Right? See? And this is what's going on. This is aggression to me, and it's violence to me, right? It's at the lowest level. If I'm going to steal your bank account and mess up your life, that's violence.
Yeah.
See? And so we do have to stop it for that reason.
Yeah.
I'm all for a criminal being smart and stealing some money. But when you do it just to mess people up and ruin their life, that's a whole different person. And I think we see more of those people now. You know what I'm saying?
You know, a very good point. You're seeing more of all types of hackers, period.
Yeah.
But the ones that are a threat to banking and the financial system, they exist for one reason. Money, profit.
They're trying to make money, okay.
Think about billions and billions of dollars.
It's an easier criminal to profile in a way.
Yes.
You know.
They're easier to predict.
Yeah.
Although you still have the issue of banks and other organizations. We protect all types of enterprises. We go beyond banking. We're making a big move into healthcare. If you're one of those organizations, you have to protect 1,000 points of vulnerability, but the attacker can pick just one and put all their resources
That's
against
right.
that.
Right.
So if you look at game theory, it's very tough for the defender to begin with. Hackers aren't going anywhere. Their numbers are rising. They're incredibly sophisticated. But talking about, you know, sharing information, the more layers of information, the more reference points. If in the old days it was one, username and password. Then it became, you know, two. Give me an OTP or a token that's far more secure, or do it by SMS, which isn't as secure. Then we started adding layers. So now we're up to, in the best case, we're up to about somewhere between 12 and 15 layers. We're going to 20 layers.
Wow.
Think 3 years from now, there'll probably be 50 layers. There could be 100 layers of reference points. And there's the computing power that exists now to look at all 100 of those and in real time create a risk profile and say, is this a real person? Even if it's all publicly available,
wow.
Does this fit the profile of a legitimate transaction? The ones that don't, then the aggravation you're talking about. Now, how much trouble are they going to give me just to do a transaction? I don't like that. Only do it to those people or those situations that are risky.
Higher
Everybody
risk,
else
right.
just walks right through TSA without even being looked at.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody wants to hack my bank account. There's no money in it. But if there was, I'd be an instant target, right? On the other hand, I'm quasi-public, and people know me and see me. So I'm at a little higher risk in one way.
For sure.
Right. So that's the analysis you have to make. John, this has been a fascinating conversation.
Absolutely.
We always learn something.
I've enjoyed
it. Thank
you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Give us John Gunn. Now give me your website again.
It's www.vasco.com.
Vasco.com. All right.
Yes.
All right. Thanks for coming on Security Guy Radio.
My pleasure. I enjoyed it.
Pleasure, John. Thank you.
Thank you as well.
Oh, let's get a picture from Chuck here. Welcome to Security Guy Radio at
Black Hat USA.
I'm going to start over. Hold on. I'm getting tired. All right. 1, 2, 3. Welcome to Security Guy Radio at Black Hat 2016. What's your name, sir?
Bill Keeler, director at Cyber Reason.
What does Cyber Reason do?
Cyber Reason is a security company, obviously, and we have taken a new approach to finding the bad guys, the adversaries. We've basically taken an approach that we're going to attack the bad guys and turn the tables on them.
I like it.
Make them the victims.
More of an offensive approach.
An offensive approach to security.
Now, is that unique in your business? Seems like
very unique. You may have heard of something called threat hunting. And threat hunting's been terminology that's been around for several years, and many companies are doing it. We happen to protect, at Cyber Reason, endpoints, smartphones, servers, printers, laptops, those types of devices. And our founders, who were in the Israeli military, figured out years ago that one way to turn the tables on the bad guys was to take an offensive approach. The best defense is a good offense.
Right.
It's a sports analogy. It's been used many times over again. And it's really, really enabled us to grow the company quickly, to obtain new customers in pharmaceutical areas, finance, hospitals, medical, etc. And there's no shortage, unfortunately, of stories in the news relating to hacks and theft of IP.
Absolutely.
And the consequences and ramifications of that can be very severe.
Now, when I was at Disney, I started their intellectual property protection program for pre-theatrical screenings. So back in the day, people would take a camera, go inside a pre-screening, and film the movie and sell it for a dollar downtown in the alley, right? And what we did is we would take fake file names of Pirates of the Caribbean and flood the Juarez sites and put a million of those file names up there so you didn't know what the real one was, right? That was aggressive in a way, kind of, you know,
very proactive.
Kind of thing. So how does Cyber Reason handle the offense and attack part? I don't want you to give away any secrets, but, you know, it sounds like if you're attacking them, obviously you're not breaking the law, but what do you do for countermeasures that make them shut down, stay away, back off?
Yeah, it's a good question.
Different than regular, oh, you got through my gateway, let me turn you off now. That's not the same thing. You're going to their gateway.
Right. We're going to their gateway, and we're also doing it in what we call an automated fashion. Manually, you know, having a team in a security operations center or a SOC go after some of these adversarial nations or rogue hacking groups is very difficult. It's very technical. So through behavioral analysis, threat intelligence, machine learning, we've come up with a platform. When you put all of that together, it enables our team to go out and help these banks and hospitals and pharmaceutical companies find patterns with which hackers try to break into networks. If you know what the hackers are doing and you think like a hacker, you're going to be more successful in determining where they are, what part of the network they're trying to get into, and what information they may be trying to steal.
Now, I've heard a lot today the term behavioral analytics and utilizing that and integrating it into your existing platform and products for this next generation type of technology and capabilities. Can you explain a little bit more on that end?
Yeah, it would simply be that you are understanding what the behaviors of the adversaries are. So our founders, being in the Unit 8200 portion of the Israeli Defense Forces, were carrying out some of the biggest cyber attacks against adversarial nations when they were part of the military. They know the behaviors. They know how hackers are thinking. And if you put all that together in a software platform in a very automated fashion to be able to secure hundreds of thousands or millions of endpoints. So when I mentioned a cell phone or a smartphone or a laptop, think about some of the largest companies in the world that have tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of employees. Each employee may have two or three endpoints.
Yep.
Right.
If you think about how that scales globally, the hacker's looking for one weak point in a network,
yep,
and they will probe and they will look and they will hunt until they find that weak point. And it's up to the end users, the pharma companies, the banks and the hospitals, to figure out what strategies are necessary to keep those adversaries from being successful. It's taking new approaches, and that's why we feel like our hunting platform and hunting engine, taking a much more aggressive and offensive approach to going after the bad guys, is really enabling our customers to turn the tables.
Now, when you find them,
I was just going to ask,
does it, you don't hack them, I assume?
No.
But you're ahead of the game. Before they get there, you know who they are, and now you're better able to block them. Is that a good way to say it?
It's a very good way of saying it, because if you look at some of the bigger hacks that have been in the news, it's oftentimes that the hackers poked and prodded and looked for different entry points into the network. If we, with our automated platform, can spot an attack and then find multiple ways to shut it down across a broad network, at the end of the day, we're helping our customers and being more successful and keeping IP safe and keeping proprietary data safe. And really, the end goal is to keep our customers out of the headlines.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
No one wants to be in the headlines for being hacked.
Absolutely.
No, and C-level guys are losing their jobs over this stuff now.
There was a study a few years ago about how more than 80% of CEOs were completely oblivious to the fact that their enterprise, their company, was being hacked on a regular basis.
No, I believe it.
Now,
yeah,
that number would be a lot lower today, but I'm guessing not much lower than 60 or 70%.
Right.
Companies are at least finally addressing those issues and addressing the concerns. And
So I kind of feel like, just being in this space for as long as I have been, not going to date myself here, but the proactiveness, do you feel like this is still kind of a new approach that companies are still not necessarily rapidly adopting? Or is there been a shift in the mentality of organizations realizing they have to change their approach to more proactiveness instead of being more on the defensive side?
I think that the terminology around offensive is still new. Threat hunting has been a term that's been used for several years. And with many different technologies, sometimes it takes a little bit longer, or it takes a few years for it to be adopted.
Yeah.
There are many companies out there selling threat hunting solutions, where we believe that Cyber Reason is unique, is that we're being really, really aggressive in terms of being very offensive, taking the attack to the bad guys and using an unparalleled level of ability that our founding team brought from the Israeli military, and knowing the strategies, and really being hackers themselves. Being in Israel, a country of 8 million people, in the area that they're in the Middle East, they're being attacked from all sorts of different areas and by big countries and small countries. And the training and the expertise that our founders built as being part of the IDF was really the genesis for the platform and the genesis for the company.
Now, when you say hackers, what percentage, it's just a guess, would you attribute to a state being involved in this as opposed to a private guy who's just an ass and wants to make some money? Are you seeing more state enterprises involved in this, countries and things like that?
You know, evidenced by hacks against Sony, hacks against the DNC most recently. The nation-state adversaries have certainly upped their game.
And they're not financial gain. They are more about...
more publicity?
There are hacktivist groups,
trying to
right?
change opinion, maybe, or something like that.
If you're familiar with the Anonymous group,
yes. Yeah.
So Anonymous was oftentimes looking for a political gain. They were trying to make a political statement against the company. That was certainly the case with the Sony hackings.
Yeah.
But other adversarial groups are looking to monetize their hacks. They're looking to steal the IP. They're looking to sell it on the dark web. And they're looking to take advantage of it in that particular fashion. There are rogue hacking groups out there doing really, really bad things. There are state-sponsored groups doing really, really bad things. And the reality today is you've got to find new ways to protect what is important to you, and that's that IP. It could be customer data. It could be your own data. And like I said, our role is to protect our customers and to protect more companies and try to keep them from being in the headlines for the wrong reasons.
So you mentioned that you focus a lot on the endpoint security. How are you, or if you're not, have you considered how Cyber Reason plays a role in the Internet of Things space, as there's been a lot of talk around this conference about how are we going to manage it, how are we going to secure it, and how it affects the threat landscape? Does Cyber Reason play a role in that?
We definitely play a role in that. When you think of IoT and you think of the excitement around the connected world that we live in, it does, to a lot of people, open their eyes to the fact that there are a lot of security risks involved with everything that is connected with a processor to a network somewhere. It could be the shopping list that you're keeping electronically on your refrigerator.
Yep.
It could be the fact that you're electronically able to schedule your next oil change. It could be anything like that in a small or broad scale. And I don't think that we've really come to the point where we really know how important IoT could be a year from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now.
Absolutely.
There's threats and incidents down the road that we don't even know about yet. And there will be many challenges for companies that are promoting the benefits of IoT, because at the end of the day, if you're not able to secure the information, and I go back to securing IP, the legal ramifications, branding ramifications that companies could face from bad publicity.
That's right. That'll kill you first before
and
the financial
loss. And if you think
loss.
Of it at a bigger scale, think about the ramifications in hospitals with
Absolutely.
Defibrillators being connected.
Yep.
And we all remember the Homeland episode years ago with the vice president having the defibrillator.
Totally doable.
This is real world stuff that could happen. And the ramifications could be, you know, life-threatening.
Now, Cyber Reason has a set of clients, and your data that you gather from those clients is about a set amount of hackers. It's a subgroup of a giant group of all the hackers in the world, let's say, right? Do you take that reason, does Cyber Reason take that data and then use that for specific analysis where you might compare it with somebody else, share it with law enforcement? I don't know. In other words, you're going to see patterns with your clients that could be unique.
Correct.
Maybe you have that one hacker that nobody else has.
It's important to be sharing as much information in the cyber community as you can. Companies are subscribing to threat intelligence and utilizing the good work that companies that specifically work in that field do to gather information on the bad guys. And companies typically will pool those resources to share it to better understand what the hackers
are
doing. And in instances where we've been able to help a pharma customer or a bank or a hospital, and if we're able to share the intel that we have and the insights that we have for the betterment of the universe, the betterment of the industry, then we would absolutely do that. And most companies, I think, would.
Well, that's good. That's good. Is there anything on the horizon that you think is the next big threat that's maybe not a priority right now? People are kind of saying, well, we'll look at that someday, but do you think they should look at it
sooner?
Well,
I think in the short term, right, think about the political ramifications of our election in November.
Yeah.
We've already had the WikiLeaks hack. I would venture a guess that if the WikiLeaks group had divulged those emails 4 or 5 months ago, and not taking a political stance either way, the Sanders camp would have had a much easier time to cry foul. Those emails were leaked only a couple of days before the DNC started, leaving them with really no opportunity to really dig in and make a political statement.
It lends to the assumptions of why it was leaked at the time it was leaked and by whom.
It's all orchestrated.
Have been instances overseas where Putin in Russia, his campaigns have been accused of taking down websites of competitors during election seasons. There were issues in South Korea within the past couple of years within an election. From a political standpoint, there could actually be election-altering ramifications from hacks or the divulgence of information either on the Clinton side or the Trump side or any candidate that's running.
Right.
Not even necessarily for national office. It could be a senatorial race in a state. It could be a selectman race in a community, in a state.
And it could be a subtle manipulation that is never discovered, but alter something.
Our CTO was giving me an example of how, if you think on the bigger picture, the bigger ramification, on election day, a hacking group could conceivably shut an electrical system down and cause chaos in a city where the traffic lights no longer work. And voters just give up and say, there's a 4-hour wait to get to the voting poll. I'm going to stay home. If that was magnified across large cities, how about in Ohio or Florida, swing states?
Right.
These are scenarios that could potentially play themselves out over time.
More so now than maybe 4 years ago, 8 years ago. I think we're going to continue to see a progression towards that ramification and possibility.
Well, Beryl, thanks for scaring the hell out of us. That's very informative.
I'm trying not to do that.
I know.
I hope you'll think more about, offensive strategies. The best defense is a good offense.
Absolutely. I agree with you. You got to bring it to them, and then you have some kind of control. And one of their elements is fear. They want us to all be afraid. And when you're afraid, you don't act properly. And if you're taking it to them, you're not afraid, right?
Our customers all the time say, you have really, really helped us. It's not about scaring corporations. It's about the reality that we live
in
today. And our platform is making a huge difference. And as we grow as a company, we'll have even a bigger impact here in North America and globally. And we're doing a lot of really, really good work for reputable companies around the world.
Bill, thanks for coming on the show.
You're
CyberReason.com. And let's sign up for a 60-minute show and tell us some of your case studies.
Thank you so much for having
me.
Thanks again.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Thanks for coming on.
You guys were great.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much. I appreciate it.